It's getting very interesting, I believe, is it not? Little children are studied for these recent days that we've been, the studies we've been doing, and it's now today, the first day of February, 2024 of the Common Era. A new month begins, and the time is 2011 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you again. Apophis is the Pharaoh of the Northern Kingdom. We've been talking about him. At the time of Moses, who Moses having been born, that is, in 1572 BCE. And Apophis lived from that time on another 29 years, all the time Moses matured. And here's a fascinating thing about this. The only daughter known to Pharaoh Apophis was Heret, H-E-R-I-T. That daughter, by elimination, being the one who adopted Moses, because the Bible tells us that the Pharaoh, the daughter of Pharaoh, adopted or found Moses and adopted him. A vase belonging to Heret was found in the tomb of Pharaoh Amenhotep I, indicating her possible marriage to a pharaoh of the south. I got very excited about this when I was researching this article, way back in whatever year it was, 2010 or something, indicating the marriage, possibly, of Heret to a pharaoh of the south. That's fascinating, because the northern and southern kingdoms were enemies, generally, and eventually, anyway, they were, and we know that because Amos the first, who was the father of Amenhotep I, he drove out the Hyksos. So how did this vase belonging to the daughter of the northern king come to be in the tomb of Pharaoh Amenhotep I? It's very exciting. And this gives a reason for great excitement with regard to Moses, also, who fought, because he fought the Nubians in the south, which, of course, the Nubians were further south than the southern kingdom of Egypt. The history cannot prove anything. That's the point to remember. The history doesn't prove anything. But it itself is proven in the crucible, which is our chronology. That's because we have the chronology we have. You see? That's why it turned out that Heret was the Pharaoh's daughter who adopted Moses, because we have the chronology of Moses that coincided with the Egyptian chronology, which gave us Apophis as the Pharaoh at that time. So our chronology decided everything here. It proved and decided, or it will prove or disprove. Every fact that we can bring to light, whether it makes sense or not, will be determined by the crucible. It's like when, you know, the facts are like when metals are separating in a crucible after you melt them, right? It's like the crucible, the chronology, it melts the facts or purifies the facts as metals separate when liquid. The facts become separate and distinct within the chronology, and they just become visible. Like, we wouldn't even know that Heret had been the Pharaoh's daughter who adopted Moses if we didn't have a chronology. So it's fascinating, really, isn't it? So, little children, Ecclesiastes 9 and 4 is today's scripture from Proverbs, which is written by, of course, the author of many Proverbs, Solomon. Inspired by Jehovah, he wrote in verse 4 of chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes, "For as respects whoever is joined to all the living, there exists confidence, because a live dog is better off than a dead lion." Now, that is remarkably good advice for anyone who's ever lived on the street. They know this. It's better to stay alive. That's what you're trying to do when you're homeless, for example. And I haven't spent much time homeless, but just enough time to understand what that means. Now, let's look at our reading for today in 2 Kings. Yesterday, I published two articles, one of which was the original French version of the article I translated, which in the translated copies called Biblical Chronology Fixed by Cuneiform Eclipses, and in the French, La Chronologie Biblique Fixée par les Eclipses Cuneiformes, I think it is, in French, and it was written by Julius Oppert, and it made a very clear understanding of the Book of Second Kings, which we've been having, or which we've seen, has a few problems, one of which was this, the one copyist error regarding the year 20 of Jotham, which was corrected by Mr. Oppert, who really believed in the Bible. Now, 2 Kings 16 says, we've only used 5 minutes and 50 seconds so far, but 2 Kings 16 says, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, became the king of Judah. And 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and for 16 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And the important thing we noted in the title of our audio and video files yesterday was in 17:1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, that was when Hoshea became king. Not in the 20th year of Jotham, but it was in the 12th year of Ahaz, which is at least 8 years after the 20th year of Jotham, if Jotham had ruled for 20 years. So that is seen to be, and there may be other ways to resolve it, but Mr. Oppert's way of resolving it was brilliant, because he saw, and it looks like he corrected the Northern Kingdom chronology when he saw this error. He was able to see that a repeated phrase, concerning the kings of the Northern Kingdom, which included a second king called Menahem, who was a different king from the first king called Menahem, that repetition could have been seen by the copyist as being a mistake or a redundant or unnecessary sentence and could have been removed. And that's why it ended up reading the 20th year of Jotham, which it shouldn't have. It should have read after the death of Jotham. And he corrected that by seeing that the letters in Hebrew, which can signify numbers, also signify words if the correct reading is given, if the rendering is correct, if the copyist is completely accurate, then it can be rendered in an entirely different way. But the missing sentences were what was causing the biggest problem. And Mr. Oppert was able to brilliantly resolve the problem in his article, which I translated and published online in the JW box yesterday. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and I've probably published it before, I have, because it's linked in the English copy to more than one article, including the Crucible article. But in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, became king. We saw that he reigned for 16 years, but look at what it says in verse 2. He did not do what was right in the eyes of Jehovah his God, like David his forefather. But verse 3 is even worse. And he went walking in the way of the kings of Israel. And look at this. Even his own son he made pass through the fire. He burned his own firstborn son alive as a sacrifice to the false idol gods, according to the detestable things of the nations whom Jehovah drove out because of the sons of Israel. He was the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a good king, but the father of Hezekiah sacrificed his own son, burning the baby alive in the fire. Isn't that shocking? It's just so detestable and so inconceivable for anybody who has any kind of morality. And he kept sacrificing and making sacrificial smoke on the high places and upon the hills and under every luxuriant tree. He did even more besides that, but that was the worst thing perhaps that he did that we know about, was sacrifice his own son. It was then the reason the king of Syria and Pekah the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, proceeded to come up against Jerusalem in war and laid siege against Ahaz, but they were not able to fight. At that time, Rezin, the king of Syria, restored Elath to Edom, after which he cleared out the Jews from Elath. yeah, we'd seen that Edom had been conquered by one of the kings of Judah. I think we saw that recently, right? Yeah, in 2 Kings 14, we saw he restored it to Judah. This was, it was Azariah, or Uzziah, as he was also called. He was the one who built Elath and got to restore it to Judah. Verse 21 and 22 of 2 Kings 14. But now, Elath has been restored to the Edomites, and the Edomites, for their part, entered Elath and kept dwelling there down to this day. So, at this time, Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. He's a very famous king of Assyria. He reigned from about 745 BCE, or 744, as Mr. Oppert says. But that's very close to the same number. And that agrees with our chronology, because in 741 in our chronology, Ahaz became king, 16 years before Hezekiah in 725. And that's shown, you'll see that in the same article we've been using all along for the chronology. What have I chosen to show here? Oh, yeah, I'm going to show something when we get to Ezekiel, hopefully. We've got to get going on our reading, though. And here we have Ahaz ruling 16 years, then Hezekiah from 725 to 696, but Ahaz from 741 to 725. That's very close to the time of 745, from which date Tiglath-Pileser III, as he was called in the conventional chronology, that's his name, but same name, but he's called the third because there were other Tiglath-Pilesers prior to him. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me out of the palm of the king of Syria and out of the palm of the king of Israel who are rising up against me. Accordingly, Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was to be found at the house of Jehovah and in the treasures of the king's house and sent to the king of Assyria a bribe. Right? Now, some bribes are legal, and this is one of the cases where bribes are legal. But it's not that Jehovah would have approved of this, though, because he didn't believe, Jehovah didn't approve of believing in other nations to assist us, or to assist his people, I should say. At that, the king of Assyria listened to him, and the king of Assyria went up to Damascus and captured it, and led its people into exile at Kir, and Rezin he put to death. Then King Ahaz went to meet Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, at Damascus, and this is why we don't trust in foreign nations as God's people, because Ahaz got to see the altar that was in Damascus after Tiglath-Pileser helped him, and Ahaz became sympathetic toward the religion of the Assyrians. So Ahaz sent Urijah the priest the design of the altar and its pattern as respects all its workmanship. And Urijah the priest proceeded to build the altar, according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus, was the way that Urijah the priest made it, until the time that King Ahaz came from Damascus. When the king came from Damascus, the king got to see the altar, and the king began to go near to the altar and make offerings upon it. And he continued to make his burnt offering and his grain offering smoke. These would be the animal offerings and the grain offering, and to pour out his drink offering and to sprinkle the blood of the communion sacrifices that were his upon the altar. But this was a different altar, but Jehovah's altar, which is the copper altar that was before Jehovah, he now brought near from in front of the house, from between the altar and the house of Jehovah, and put it at the north side of his altar. And King Ahaz went on to command him, even Urijah the priest, saying, upon the great altar, meaning the corrupt Assyrian altar, make the burnt offering of the morning smoke, and also the grain offering of the evening, and the burnt offering of the king, and his grain offering, and the burnt offering of all the people of the land, and their grain offering, and their drink offerings, and all the blood of burnt offering, and all the blood of a sacrifice you should sprinkle upon it. As for the copper altar, which was Jehovah's altar, it will become something for me to take under consideration. So he was abandoning the altar of Jehovah, which Jehovah most certainly would not have been in agreement with, and with which, you know, he would not have approved. And Urijah the priest went doing according to all that King Ahaz had commanded. Further, King Ahaz cut the sidewalls of the carriages in pieces and removed from off them the basins. Basins had been on carriages before, and the sea he took down off the copper bulls that were underneath it, and then put it upon a stone pavement and the covered structure for the Sabbath that they had built in the house and the king's outer entryway. He shifted from the house of Jehovah because of the king of Assyria. The covered structure for the Sabbath was something that, it sounds like it was something that he had built. That wasn't something that was original to the temple. But these other things were, the carriages were, with their basins, and the copper bulls with the sea on top of it, the large copper sea. That was original to the temple utensils. He modified them. And as for the rest of the affairs of Ahaz, what he did, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Judah? They weren't good in Jehovah's eyes. Finally, Ahaz lay down with his forefathers and was buried with his forefathers in the city of David. And Hezekiah, his son, began to reign in place of him. Now, Hezekiah was a much better king, much, much, much better king. We'll see that, hopefully, soon. Let's look at our reading from Ezekiel today. I don't know if we'll read it all, but there's a lot of repetition in this. I think we will, hopefully we'll have time and we'll read it all. But it's not something you have to be terribly worried about. You don't have to know everything. It's hard to absorb all the information because it's very repetitive and very technical in this chapter. But we want to at least read it at least one time, you know. In the 25th year of our exile, in the start of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck down, and that's a very, very important chronological thing. Because look what it says, 25th year of our exile, in the start of the year, on the 10th day of the month. And one commentator from a book that was written quite a while ago commented that what day is the start of the year if it's the 10th day of the month? And it's only the Jubilee year that starts on the 10th day of the first month. That's only in the year of the Jubilee that that happens. And that means that the 25th year of their exile was the year of Jubilee, or the 50th year of the Jubilee. And that's completely in agreement with the fifth year of their exile having been the 30th year, 50 minus 20. And that's what chapter 1, verse 1 of Ezekiel says. It says, in verse 1 and 2, that is, in the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, it says the 30th year, it says, let's read it, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, while I was in the midst of the exiled people, that the heavens were opened, and I began to see visions of God. So this is another vision of God that we're reading about in chapter 40, by the way. And Adam Clark, in his commentary, mentions that this vision in chapter 40 continues all the way to the end of the book of Ezekiel, this vision that we're reading and beginning to read today. It goes on to the end of the book. So that's good to know, because we can relax now and just read the rest of Ezekiel. But here it says in verse 2, on the fifth day of the month, that is in the fifth year of the exile. So the 30th year of the Jubilee is the fifth year of the exile. That's what we've learned from those two chapters together, chapter 40 and chapter, and I'll find out who it was who said this, if I can, soon. I mean, soon. The sooner I can find out, I will. About that, chapter 40, verse 1, being the year of the Jubilee, somebody important, some scholar wrote that in a book that wasn't written too recently. So it's been known for quite a long time by some people. But look at this. It says it was on the 14th day after the city had been struck down, and that's the most important of all, probably, of this. Well, not the most. No, I think the Jubilee information is very important. It gives us knowledge about all sorts of different time periods prior to this also. But the 14th year after the city had been struck down, that's really important, because that means and it was the 25th year of the exile, you see, so 11 years difference. That means that the exile was 11 years before the city was struck down, and that's exactly right. It was in you know, exactly the 11th year when this happened. It's in the Julian calendar, there's 10-year difference in some months, so it's perfect in harmony here with what our chronology is. In the visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel. And so we see it's another vision, and gradually set me down upon a very high mountain on which there was something like the structure of a city to the south. We might run out of time here because this is a long chapter, but I think we might have time if we don't do any of the New Testament today. And he proceeded to bring me there, and look, there was a man. His appearance was like the appearance of copper, and there was a flax cord in his hand and a measuring reed, and he was standing in the gate. And the man began to speak to me, "Son of man, see with your eyes and with your ears hear, and set your heart upon all that I am showing you, because for the purpose of my showing you, you have been brought here. Tell everything that you are seeing to the house of Israel. And look, there was a wall outside the house all around about. And in the hand of the man there was the measuring reed of 6 cubits by a cubit and a handbreadth." The cubit and a handbreadth, according to the footnote, is 44.5 centimeters, or 17.5 inches, plus a handbreadth of 7.4 centimeters, or 2.9 inches, which equaled about 51.8. That's actually 51.9. It looks, but well, at least in the rounded off, it might be 9, but it's 51.8, or 20.4 inches, which is the long cubit. But we saw a cubit in the Ark of Urartu, which it says in part one of the Ark of Urartu, the length of the Egyptian cubit, this was an article that yours truly had written, was determined to be 20.6 inches based on the length of the Ark. I didn't make that number up either. That was given by all the research that I had done into what the cubit was to the Egyptians. And that was used by Moses, apparently, in the determination of his size of the ark, because when they found the ark, it was exactly the number of cubits that the Bible said, based on this cubit of 20.6 inches of the Egyptians. So that's not too different from 20.4 inches. Maybe, in fact, the cubit and the handbreadth of Israel was also 20.6, because 20.4 is not very different from that. And he came to the gate, the front of which is toward the east. But he began to measure the breadth of the thing built, it says in verse 5, one reed, and the height one reed. Then he came to the gate, the front of which is toward the east. Well, okay, each reed, though, was 6 cubits by a cubit and a handbreadth, so 6. So that meant that 6 cubits in the footnote equaled 3.11 meters. See that in the footnote here? 3.11, or 10.2 feet. That was what the reed was in length. So about 10 feet and the height of 10 feet. Then he came to the gate, the front of which is toward the east. So it says there was a wall, right? Outside the house, all round about. The breadth was one reed or 10 feet, and the height was 10 feet. It's not quite clear exactly what he's saying. But when he came to the gate, the front of which is toward the east, he went up by its steps, and he began to measure the threshold of the gate, one reed in width, and the other threshold, one reed in width. Interesting, we say threshold, whereas with regard to thrashing the wheat, even though it's spelled the same, it's pronounced thrashing. This is called the threshold. And the guard chamber was one reed in length. Of course, the threshold is the entrance way that you cross over when you step upon the threshold. One reed in width, right, of the gate, for the gate's threshold, and the other threshold, one reed in width. And the guard chamber was one reed in length and one reed in width, and between the guard chambers there were 5 cubits. And the threshold of the gate beside the porch of the gate toward the interior was one reed. So don't worry about trying to absorb all of this. Just try and take it in and stay relaxed in your mind. Allow your mind to be relaxed, little children. And he proceeded to measure the porch of the gate toward the interior, one reed. So he measured the porch of the gate, 8 cubits, and its side pillars, 2 cubits. One reed, remember, is 6 cubits. And the porch of the gate was toward the interior. And the guard chambers of the gate toward the east were 3 on this side and 3 on that side. The 3 of them were of the same measurement, and the side pillars were of the same measurement on this side and on that side. Time is going quickly. Then he measured the width of the entrance of the gate, 10 cubits, the length of the gate, 13 cubits. It says nothing about time in the chapter. It's just, I mentioned that. And the fenced area in front of the guard chambers was 1 cubit, and there was a fenced area of 1 cubit on either side. And the guard chamber was 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. And he went on to measure the gate from the roof of the one guard chamber to the roof of the other. A width of 25 cubits, entrance was across from entrance. Now he's not talking about the reed anymore, which is 6 cubits. He's talking about the measurement in cubits all the time. So we don't need the reed anymore. Then he made side pillars of 60 cubits, even to the side pillars of the courtyard and the gates all around, and by the front of the gate of the entryway to by the front of the porch of the inner gate was 50 cubits. And there were windows of narrowing frames for the guard chambers and for the side pillars toward the inside of the gate all around. And that is the way it was for the porches. And the windows were all around toward the inside, and on the side pillars there were palm tree figures. And he gradually brought me into the inner courtyard, the outer courtyard, sorry. And look, there were dining rooms and a pavement made for the courtyard all around. There were 30 dining rooms upon the pavement, and the pavement at the side of the gates was exactly as the length of the gates, the lower pavement. And he proceeded to measure the width from in front of the lower gate to the front of the inner courtyard. Outside it was 100 cubits to the east and to the north. That was the inner courtyard, to the front a bit. Outside it was 100 cubits to the east and to the north, and the outer courtyard had a gate, the front of which was toward the north. He measured its length and its width, and its guard chambers were 3 on this side and 3 on that side, and its own side pillars and its own porch proved to be, according to the measurement of the first gate, 50 cubits was its length, and its width was 25 in cubits, and its windows and its porch and its palm tree figures were of the same measurement as those of the gate, the front of which is toward the east, and by 7 steps people could go up into it, and its porch was to their front. Right. And the gate of the inner courtyard was opposite the gate to the north, verse 23, also one to the east, and he proceeded to measure from gate to gate 100 cubits. Verse 24, and he gradually brought me toward the south, and look, there was a gate toward the south, and he measured its side pillar and its porch as of the same measurements as these. And it and its porch had windows all around like these windows. 50 cubits was the length, and the breadth was 25 cubits. And there were 7 steps for going up to it, and its porch was to their front. And it had palm tree figures, one on this side and one on that side, on its side pillars. And the inner courtyard had a gate toward the south, and he measured from gate to gate toward the south 100 cubits. And he gradually brought me into the inner courtyard by the gate of the south, and he proceeded to measure the gate of the south as of the same measurements as these. And its guard chambers and its side pillars and its porch were of the same measurements as these, and it and its porch had windows round about. 50 cubits was the length, and the width was 25 cubits. And we're going to see that 50 and 25 measurement continues. And there were porches all around it. The length was 25 cubits, and the width 5 cubits, and its porch was to the outer courtyard, and the palm tree figures were on this side. And palm tree figures were on its side pillars, and its ascent was 8 steps. And now 32. Verse 32, and he gradually brought me into the inner courtyard by way of the east, and he proceeded to measure the gate as of the same measurements as these. And its guard chambers and its side pillars and its porch were of the same measurements as these, and it had its porch, and its porch had windows all around. The length was 50 cubits, and the width 25 cubits, and it's, once again, 50 by 25. And its porch was toward the outer courtyard, and palm tree figures were on its side pillars on this side and on that side. And its ascent was 8 steps. And he proceeded to bring me into the north gate, and he measured with the same measurements as these, its guard chambers, its side pillars, and its porch. And it had windows all around. The length was 50 cubits, and the width 25 cubits. And to the outer courtyard were its side pillars, and palm tree figures were on its side pillars on this side and on that side. And its ascent was 8 steps. And the dining room with its entrance by the side pillars of the gates was by the side pillars of the gates. And the dining room, verse 38, with its entrance was by the side pillars of the gates. there it was that they would rinse the whole burnt offering. And in the porch of the gate, there were two tables on this side and two tables on that side for slaughtering upon them the whole burnt offering and the sin offering and the guilt offering. Got 3 minutes. And on the outer side, as one goes up to the entrance of the north gate, there were two tables. And on the other side that belongs to the porch of the gate, there were two tables. Also, in other words, there were four tables over here and four tables over there at the side of the gate, eight tables upon which they would do the slaughtering. And the four tables for the whole burnt offering were of hewn stone. And the length was 1 cubit and a half, and the width 1 cubit and a half, and the height 1 cubit. Upon them, so sort of a low table, upon them they would also deposit the implements with which they would slaughter the whole burnt offering and the sacrifice. And the ledges for setting down things were one hand breadth, firmly fixed on the interior all around. And upon the tables they would deposit the flesh of the gift offering. And on the outside of the inner gate, there were the dining rooms of the singers on the inner courtyard, which is on the side of the north gate, and their front side was toward the south. There was one on the side of the east gate, the front was toward the north. And he proceeded to speak to me, "This one, the dining room, the front of which is toward the south, is for the priests who are taking care of the obligation of the house. And the dining room, the front of which is toward the north, is for the priests who are taking care of the obligation of the altar. They are the sons of Zadok, who, from the sons of Levi, are approaching Jehovah to minister to him." Got about 2 minutes. And he went measuring the inner courtyard. The length was 100 cubits, and the width 100 cubits, 4 square, and the altar was before the house. And he proceeded to bring me into the porch of the house, and he went measuring the side pillar of the porch, 5 cubits on this side and 5 cubits on that side, and the width of the gate was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. Isn't that fascinating? We're talking about the actual altar in the book of Ezekiel, which is only talked about right here, it seems to me, not anywhere else or not in too many places in the book of Ezekiel. And it was also mentioned in the book of 2 Kings with regard to the King Ahaz, who had brought a different sort of altar from Assyria. So it's a remarkable, incredible, phenomenal correspondence that we're finding in our study, which I didn't plan. Jehovah did this. The length of the porch was 20 cubits, and the width 11 cubits, or 12 cubits, in the Greek Septuagint version. And by steps was how they would go up to it, and there were pillars by the side posts, one over here and one over there. And we're just about done our study. That was a remarkable timing. We've got no time to talk about 1 and 2 Peter, or the Apostle Peter and his letter, his two letters in the Bible, which we've been talking about. But you can keep reading in the comments of Adam Clark regarding the letter of 1 Peter chapter 1, and he talks a lot there about what they know about, what scholars know about the Apostle Peter. But this prophecy in Ezekiel, we know now, the vision, this prophecy will continue to the very end of the book of Ezekiel. We're done our study. Little children, it's been wonderful to be with you again today. The date is February 1st, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 2044 hours Eastern Standard Time. That date in the BCE year is 2044, is the birth date of the patriarch Jacob, actually, also known as Israel. I love you. I'm Ward Green, and in my behalf, and I love you very much, in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now.